Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. My name is Sergio López Piñeiro, and I interview authors on how the portrayal and use of emptiness and allied concepts, such as void, nothingness, or limbo, in philosophical, political, religious, and social studies are influenced by the imagination and construction of physical space. Today, I'm talking with Kearney Campbell about the book Empty Spaces, Perspectives on Emptiness in Modern History, a book that she edited with Allegra Giovini and Jennifer Keaton and was published by University of London Press. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today, Kearney.
Thank you for inviting me.
So as a way of starting, could you introduce yourself to our listeners, please?
Sure. My name is Courtney Campbell. I am an assistant professor at the University of Birmingham in England. My official role is assistant professor in Latin American history. So I'm a Latin Americanist by training. My research focuses mostly on Brazil, 19th and 20th century Brazil, but I teach broadly on Latin America and also on global history. I'm originally from the United States. You can probably tell from my accent. I'm from Michigan originally, but I lived a long time in South America as well, mostly in Paraguay and Brazil.
Wonderful. So the book Empty Spaces, which you edited with Allegra Giovini and Jennifer Keaton, the book, it says, I quote, "The contributors argue that spaces which are considered empty are just as important to the social production of space and landscape across time as those which are remembered, celebrated, or memorialized, and moreover, that empty spaces have had a crucial role to play in the creation and dissemination of a wider set of historical ideas about nation, empire, territory, community, and self," end of quote. Could you tell us a little bit more about the book and the essays it includes?
Sure. I'll start with explaining where the book came from. All three of us, Allegra, myself, and Jen, we were postdoctoral fellows at the Institute for Historical Research in London, which is housed within the School of Advanced Studies of the University of London, along with Will Pooley, who's currently at the University of Bristol. And we, in this, as postdoctoral fellows within this institution, we each had to give a presentation on our research. Every week we met on, I think it was Fridays, and had to give a presentation of the research we were working on. And we noted at one point that we all four of us were somehow addressing spaces that were written or considered or narrated as empty in some way, and that this emptiness justified or manifested the ways that the nation or the colonizer or whatnot were thinking about these spaces. And so we sat down and talked about what to do with this, and we applied for some funding. We put on a one-day event in which several people presented on their work related to the theme of empty spaces. We received some really fascinating proposals and papers. And then we put together a workshop in order to refine these a bit and pull them together into an edited volume. In the end, it was Allegra, Jen, and I that put this together. And it was a wonderful team to work with. We really was, you know, there's a edited volumes can go a couple of ways. And it was really, really great that a really wonderful team. And really in the sense that when one person was maybe sidelined by something else, somebody else stepped in. In fact, we finished the introduction while we put the final period, I think, on these paragraphs when I went into labor. So I really needed somebody to step in the copy edit phase, for example. So we really shared this work together. The chapters are really varied and approach this idea of emptiness in different ways. How we tried to organize it is that the first four chapters kind of look at ideas of emptiness in air spaces or in territories in the 19th to early 20th centuries. There's a chapter by Kevin James on barrenness and abundance in Ireland and West Ireland. There's a Jen Keating's chapter is on Central Asia. Leonie Schuster has a chapter on aviation in Brazil. Trisha Cusack, her chapter looks at the Empire Marketing Board posters and their portrayals of the ocean. Emily Burns' chapter, which has received quite a bit of attention, is on Edward Hopper's representations of Paris as empty. Martin Walter looks at post-apocalyptic fiction. So he looks at The Walking Dead and Survivor, I believe. And Cristalia Camvasino and Sarah Ann Milne's, their chapter is looking at vacant space in London. I think their chapter reminded me most of your work, Sergio. And then finally, Kenneth Brophy, who comes from quite a different angle. He's an archaeological approach, looking at prehistoric enclosures, but really focusing in on the modern uses and perceptions of those enclosures as well. So, you know, a really varied set of chapters looking at emptiness in quite different ways. But I think we were able to pull it together in a way that that made it not just a bunch of disparate ideas about emptiness, but rather showing how emptiness is shaped and used and what it shows us.
Yeah, I mean, I like the book very, very much. I particularly really enjoyed Kenneth Brophy's chapter. I thought it spoke to me in very interesting ways. So I think that one thing that I wanted to ask you is that the book aims to put forward the need for the study of emptiness and empty space as part of spatial history in general. This is something you explain in the introduction, and then specifically as part of the so-called spatial turn of the recent past. And so I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about this for the audience. What is spatial history, and how is that different from historical geography, or anthropology, or architectural landscape, urban history, number one? And number two, what is this spatial turn, and how does the book fit within it?
So I might give a particularly not satisfying response to this question, but it's spatial history, to put it briefly and short, is a way of examining the uses of space or conceptions of space, how we use and appropriate and experience and pass through spaces throughout history. So in a way, it is a method in which a historian who is used to working with time, right, with the passage of time, a historian really focuses in on intersecting time and space together, right? and how our ideas about space also change along with our ideas about time. It is both different than all of those, the other disciplines that you mentioned, and also really similar to and crosses over with. This book is very interdisciplinary in nature. I spoke with Allegra and Jen to make sure that I'm representing the volume correctly. And I said, what do you want me to say in this? And they both really stressed the interdisciplinarity of it. And so it's very interdisciplinary. And in that way, spatial history is almost inherently interdisciplinary. It crosses over a lot with human geography. For example, you mentioned, how is it different than human geography? And there are times when it probably isn't. But I would say essentially where spatial history and human geography are different is in their historiographies and their in the way that the disciplines progressed. So human geography being more tied to sciences had a tendency for an extended period of time, particularly through the 50s and 60s, I'd say, of becoming very statistical and numbers-based and quantitative, while spatial history tends to veer further away to the more qualitative side towards social history even. Nowadays, though, I think they cross over a lot more. You still see in human geography more of a tendency to take advantage of technologies that exist, for example, that perhaps most historians aren't trained in, or quantitative methods that we tend to veer away from. But the focus itself, there's a lot of human geography now that is looking at cities, for example, and sustainabilities and cities, environmental issues related to cities. And these, this isn't places where you'll see spatial history overlapping quite a bit with human geography. Anthropology, architectural and landscape and urban history, I would say they intersect with spatial history. When we talk about spatial history, there is at least one chapter in this book that is an urban history. The Canvesino and Milne chapter would be an urban history, looks at the history of spaces that became kind of voids, urban voids, and were reappropriated in London. So, you know, you can have a spatial history that is an urban history, and you can have a spatial history that has a particularly anthropological bent to it, for example. The spatial turn is a bit of a tricky concept, because the spatial turn is what's bringing us closer to spatial history in many ways. It means, in a way, it's just the turn towards things, all things spatial, about questioning our relationships with place and space. But it also tends to have a really strong relationship with the idea of GIS and mapping and these technologies related to mapping. So there's a spatial turn that's kind of crosses over with a digital turn or a digital humanities. But so it can be a bit tricky to separate those out, because that's obviously not what we're doing in this book. We're not as interested in using those technologies as methodologies. We'd be more interested in studying them as subjects.
Mm-hmm. And so since this is an edited volume, I wanted to ask you questions a little bit more in general about the theoretical frameworks that you present in the introduction of the book, of how emptiness is defined and framed. And then through these broad questions, maybe we can talk and bring up some of the essays in the book as specific examples or conditions that can help better understand the issues surrounding empty spaces. So the questions are going to be general, but feel free to use any of the essays as material to talk about this. So I want to start with the very first quote that you use in the introduction of the book. The introduction of the book is called Confronting Emptiness in History. And the quote is by J.B. Hartley. And it says, I quote, "There is no such thing as an empty space on a map," end of quote. So very bluntly, does emptiness exist?
Yes, It does, and no, it doesn't.
Great.
Yeah, great. It's like all of my answers so far.
Yes.
Yes, it exists in that it's a discursive tool. It's something that we use to justify actions or that shows different processes that are in play. So it exists in that we recognize it and we look at it and we name it. And once you name something, it exists. And it doesn't, in the sense that once we recognize emptiness, then we notice that we've already filled it with meaning and it's not actually empty at all. So when we're talking about emptiness in these texts, in some ways, we're not talking about the real absence of matter, right? But more about ideas and concepts around emptiness and how it's being created or invented and described. And so, yes, it exists in the sense that we name it and people have perceived it as such, right? And that is real. Our experience is real. Our perceptions are real. Whether or not they stand up to, you know, academic scrutiny or not. Everything is full of meaning.
So this is a very interesting question to me. So in some ways, one could say that the authors of the different texts in the book, their mission is to reveal all of the elements and all of the meanings that are generally left outside of those spaces which are categorized as empty by some power at be or by some community or institution. So there's a kind of recognition of that naming of emptiness and the people, the meanings, the stuff that has been left aside in order to construct an emptiness. So in some ways, the process of, and this I think happens with the majority of the texts in the book, it's a question of deconstructing or eliminating or filling up that idea of emptiness. Would that be fair?
Maybe. I know I'm the most evasive person. Yes, it is in a way that we are trying to say, look, they might have been saying that this is empty, but it's not really empty. Mm-hmm. So there is a bit of that, recognizing somebody else's misframing or misjudgment. Though I don't know that it's always intentional. I want to make that clear too. But I do hope that this collection, that the individual articles and that the collection as a whole moves beyond simply, you know, pointing a finger and saying, haha, you were wrong. It's not really empty. But instead showing that what the purpose of that discourse of emptiness was, what purpose it served, or rather, and perhaps more important, what processes it manifests, what we learn from that process of creating emptiness and of describing emptiness and recognizing that it's not actually maybe as empty as some might have thought or might have wanted people to think. I think, for example, of Leonie Schuster's article on aviation and the Brazilian nation. She's looking at Edu Chavez's cross-country flights in 1912. So Edu Chavez had these attempts at going as far as possible, and the idea that he is not just filling the airspace considered empty, right, with a plane and cross cutting it then with these paths, right, that the airplane flies on, or even filling the airspace with hope of some kind of technological event and progress, but also that he's connecting cities and parts of this, you know, Brazilian territory that is seeking modernity in the early 20th century and trying to really express its modernity. And part of what through most of the 20th century is felt in Brazil that is in the way of that modernity are these seemingly empty or sparsely populated territories of the hinterlands that you have to get through to connect these modern cities together, right? And in a way, Edu Chavez, his flights are getting rid of that, right? He can fly over these empty spaces that aren't empty. They're full of people. They're full of agriculture. They're full of stereotypes, and meaning that has been placed upon them by federal governments and by the nation. And considering them empty then has repercussions. It leaves people behind. It frames whole regions or places as obstacles. It devalues one place in comparison with another. So I hope that we move beyond just saying, you know, these places aren't empty. You were wrong, but instead to move to show why it's important to recognize that and what we learn from it about modernity, progress, ideas of modernity, ideas of progress, and the spread of imperialism, capitalism, and nation in the 20th century.
So you argue in the book, and I think that the title makes it very clear that and I'm quoting actually from the intro, emptiness is not the lack of physical or imaginative content, but rather a condition that grants value to the modern spaces discussed in this volume, end of quote. And in another sentence, you say empty spaces then become a lens, a metaphor, a foil, or tool for working through the anxieties of modernity. Can you talk a little bit more about this, which I think is a follow up of what you were saying, and you were just like talking about, and you were using Leonie Schuster's text as an example of the construction of a particular modernity.
So what we were getting at there is that when we're looking at emptiness, we're not just looking at physical emptiness, but rather using that emptiness to try to understand other processes. If we look at, for example, Jennifer Keating's contribution on Central Asia and imperial history. She looks, for example, at desert landscapes and mm-hmm. how those desert landscapes might have been perceived of as empty, but really they what that meant, particularly within these imperial histories, was a threat, right? That you had to get through those areas that were characterized by dryness and by erosion, by disorientation, that it was a challenge to the empire to get through these empty spaces. And so that narrative then is a way of trying to understand the actions of Russian imperialists.
No, please go ahead.
Or when we look at, for example, at Emily Burns, who looks at Edward Hopper, at his paintings and this seeming emptiness, right? The lack of people within it. But she points out that emptiness is actually carefully constructed. And it's a construction of solitude. It's a symbol of anxiety about the artistic study abroad, about his time abroad, about his time in a space where French artistic expression was valued more than his. So you can use that emptiness then, and instead of focusing in on that emptiness, we're actually learning more about the artistic experience. So that's what we mean by using it as a lens or as a metaphor or as a tool for working through these different anxieties of modernity.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So in that context, the book, it focuses mostly on Western modern history. And so is the understanding and use of emptiness that the book puts forward exclusively Western, or would something change if we were to take into account other, particularly East Asian case studies?
That's a really good question, and I think one that, as you subtly point out in the question itself, one that this volume itself doesn't address and can't answer, because it is focused mostly on Western narratives. I suppose there's the Central Asian perspective too, but for the most part, it's focused on Western narratives. So it's a good question, and I think one that points out that there's more work to be done in this area and a lot of space for more work to be done. Because I would like to know that, and particularly I think also another area that we don't have in this volume that is missing is Africa. There's no mention of African history in here at all. So that would be another area that I think we could learn a lot about and about notions of emptiness and what they might have served in Africa, or if it was perceived differently.
I think it would illuminate the understanding of the modernity of the modern process in these regions of the world in a completely different way from the one that we have come to understand, that we have come to stereotyped within the West. So one thing that I am interested in. And you talk about in the introduction of the book, you say that the concept of emptiness is internally defined, is inherently relational, always. Things are always emptier than something else. And that's that comparison is something that we use in order to talk about the emptiness, or in order to define the emptiness of some particular place or location. But the thing is that the aesthetics of emptiness are in some ways externally defined, or at least they are externally clear to everyone. We're mostly across cultures. There is some general understanding of how emptiness looks. And so the content of emptiness, how it is defined, doesn't transfer or travel well. But the containers of emptiness, how emptiness looks, transfer extremely easily. So we can all identify emptiness very, very quickly. So is this question part of the problem in the use of emptiness, or in the mischaracterization of spaces as being empty? What are your thoughts about this interaction between the social construction and the aesthetics of emptiness in the use of the concept?
Oh, it's a really good question. I want to sit a little bit on the idea of it being relational and also of it being culturally defined, because, for example, one of the images that we that struck us in the beginning, there was an image of a from Jennifer Keating's research of a camel on the steps somewhere, and the idea being that this landscape was long viewed as being empty, but that very clearly there is an animal in that picture, right? There's something there in this photograph, and I think it's an example of how what one person might look at and say, there's nothing here. This is a no man's land. This is empty. Another person might step in and say, this is some really rich soil and territory. This is great for agricultural production. Look at how animals might thrive here, right? So it's there is some value being placed on being placed from our own cultural perspectives, right? From where we're coming from and what we see as productive or not. Or as in the chapter by Kamvasan and Milner, what they're looking at are these urban voids that are then taken up by different countercultural movements in the 1970s in London that are using these spaces in ways that weren't originally imagined for them. So in a way, these spaces step out of the capitalist notion of a space needing to be productive, needing to do something, right, for society in a certain way, in a certain urban way. And instead, they become something else. They become refashioned in different ways. So so there is, you know, there is a construction there of emptiness and that is going to, you know, one person's emptiness is another person's paradise, I guess. but yes, it's true. In representation, in the way that we represent it, it does seem rather obvious, right? If you're drawing a map and there's an empty space on that map, then we are thought to, our initial thoughts are that space is empty. And the quotation about there are no empty spaces on a map then becomes really important, because even that empty space on the map means something. There's a fantastic article in Past and Present. Oh, I'm not going to remember the title off the top of my head, but it's on mapping the Black Plague, the Black Death, I'm sorry, and how there's a map that that an area of the map was left blank because there wasn't data. But because that area of the map was left blank, it has been assumed and a narrative was constructed off of this one map to say that there must not have been a lot of deaths from the plague in that area, right? When really all it meant was there was no data from that area. So these depictions of emptiness or these blank spaces on maps, on in memories, in narratives, in landscapes, they might signify emptiness to us, but that significance might be off, might be wrong, basically.
So is there any moment when, I mean, we tend to think then in this kind of situation that emptiness is always a result of some kind of, negative process or like a lack of attention in some cases, or like some kind of exploitative or colonial attitude or a lack of data. But is there any moment in which we could, or is there any moment in which you think that emptiness can be constructed from as a result or as an output of an actually like a positive process? And I'm using here negative and positive in a very generic, very oversimplified, maybe not even useful manner. But I find that there's always like this output that is not, that seems to be like a missed opportunity of some kind.
Yeah, I guess in a way it's inherently negative, as in negative space, right? We're assuming some kind of lack or void, and so there's that sense of negative. But when we think, for example, about I think the Edward Hopper paintings are one example in which that which is missing is actually is being constructed to signify or to show feelings and emotion about a place. And so that is kind of a positive insertion of something, even if those feelings, you know, weren't positive. It is a, you know, it's an add-on. The emptiness is being added. It's not something being taken away. And I think in that sense, the Campvisano and Milne art chapter also are a way of showing kind of a positive use of empty space. And the Brophy chapter that you mentioned also does quite a bit in that sense of showing how spaces that are empty become places of interaction, of social interaction even. I think, and I'm going off the volume here, I'm a little bit outside of the volume, but you know, this volume was published a few years ago, and a lot has changed since then in the world, particularly in the last, you know, year and a half or so. And I think going back to this volume and thinking about it, I think about how our notions as a society of emptiness and what that means have changed. When there's a really fantastic archive of COVID, the COVID archive, it's basically called, I think, that's being curated out of Arizona State University. Katie Cole Pedalta works on it, and that's how I know about it. And it's an archive in which, you know, an open archive where you can just go in and upload any kind of document or source that you think shows something about COVID, right? About this experience of the pandemic, so that there's an archive of it in the future. And a lot of the things that are being uploaded are emptiness. They are depictions of empty parking lots. I uploaded photos of the empty parking lot outside of the mosque down my road and their sign that says that there are no services, because it's usually a very busy, full space. There are images of empty toilet paper shelves and empty airports. People are uploading to Facebook all the time empty airplanes that they are on. And so how this idea of emptiness has changed for us now, and what it, so what emptiness means then is changing according to, you know, our voyage through history, I suppose. And the meanings that we place upon that, for example. So, you know, the emptiness of the toilet paper shelves we would see as something, you know, negative, as people hoarding or whatnot. But maybe the emptiness of other really public spaces, other people might have been uploading to show that people are following social distancing rules and following quarantine rules, and that they might have thought of that as a positive thing. So I guess what I'm getting at here is that even when it might seem that these ideas about emptiness might be somewhat universal, they're changing and they're not fixed.
I think that this is a very interesting question in terms of, I wanted to ask you, and this is not, I think that you don't touch upon this in the book, but you talk about space as a social construct in constant transformation. And you're arguing right now that emptiness follows not a dissimilar process. It is also a social construct in constant transformation. And so in the same way that we have come to understand the role of preservation of space in specific contexts and manners, and these ideas of preservation change, is there any way, or should we be talking about the preservation of emptiness in a similar manner, since you make the argument in the book and you're describing it now with this example of emptiness, the COVID emptiness, or the desertification of spaces through the pandemic and the lockdown, there's emptiness is also a social construct. Should we be like preserving some of this emptiness in some particular way?
I suppose whether we should or not, we are.
In which way? That's interesting.
Well,
in which way?
In the sense that we're documenting it, and so it's being, you know, preserved in that sense, that it's documented. We're experiencing it. We're writing about it, about this feeling of emptiness. But in the same way, I guess we fall back on that first question that you asked me of whether anything really is empty. And I would say that what we should perhaps hold on to is that these spaces might look empty, but are they really? And what do they mean? And what is their purpose? And what is it serving for us? But I think it depends on what you mean by preservation. So I think I have to turn that question back to you. But what do you mean by preserving it?
I was actually talking more very concretely about material preservation of actual spaces, whether they're gardens, buildings, urban plazas, statues, monuments, memorials, archaeological digs, prehistoric artifacts. There is a clear understanding of some of such spaces as something that defines a very specific social construct that is worth, that is valuable, and that is worth preserving and maintaining in some way, in order for people, because they are an insight into one specific way of living with each other. And so I wonder if there is such, if there's an equivalent regarding emptiness that exists. I mean, one could say that there are, like, you know, particular, I don't know, deserts that are defined as natural reserves. But in that particular case, you're obviously, I don't think that you are preserving emptiness. You are preserving the ecosystem and the cultural associations or native cultures that took place in that specific a land. And so you're not presenting it as empty. You're presenting it as something that is full of something that is valuable to be preserved. And so again, it's presented as a kind of spatial construct with particular characteristics that need to be maintained. But emptiness as such, because I think that there's like an inherent negativity to it. I think in many cases, I wonder if there's like, I wonder if there is such thing as preserving the emptiness, or if that would be counterproductive because it would be a way of preserving a certain ignorance or a certain framework, powerful framework that displaces and discriminates certain communities, people, artifacts, ways of understanding.
I suppose it depends on, because, you know, empty of what is always the question, right? Is it devoid of sound? Should we have quiet spaces, for example, that are empty of sound or devoid of people or of buildings or of traffic or of cars, of industry? Because I think in a way, when we're looking at this book, we're talking in so many ways about again, modernity, about ideas of modernity, ideas of industrialization, of capitalism, of urbanization. So is what we're saying that we need some space that doesn't have all that stuff in it? And in that sense, I think we do that a lot, or we try to, right? We have parks and or some other kind of things like that obviously aren't empty. Nothing is, but they're empty of something. And I think that's, I think that's really important. I think one thing that Brophy's chapter again makes me think of is busyness, right? A space that isn't busy, or that's only busy with human engagement with other people in some kind of genuine way, whatever that is. I think, you know, so yes, I think in a way, trying to preserve some, in all things, right, I guess you can use, you can try to use the same tools in a way of resisting this constant process of dehumanization within which we live in the modern capitalist world. And one way of doing so might be in retaking those narratives of emptiness and trying to reclaim those empty spaces in a way that serves us, to find us some calm and a space in which we don't need to be productive.
I think that sounds like a really wonderful way of encapsulating a lot of the texts that included in the book, including Brophy's and others. I wanted to ask you, as a way of ending the interview, what are you working on right now? Are you continuing this work in some fashion, or have you moved on to other questions?
I don't know that this work will ever leave me.
Okay, great. Good to know.
But in much different ways. So I have, my book is coming out on the Brazilian Northeast. It's called Region Out of Place, the Brazilian Northeast and the World, 1924 to 1968. That is coming out with University of Pittsburgh Press next year. And it's looking at one of these, you know, I might have gone on a bit about Brazilian landscapes because that's what I work on. And the idea of the Brazilian Northeast, of course, is that it's that it was kind of the shoe in the, or I'm sorry, the stone in the shoe of Brazilian modernity and industrialization. It was more rural. It was poor. It was dry. Migrants were leaving it in a way that makes it seem like it's emptying out into the nation. And so in that sense, I work with that, the idea of how the Northeast became a cultural identity, so how people became Northeastern, but I'm looking at it as not this isolated empty space, but instead a place that really, that was very much embedded in the world and interacting with different countries and different international events, and that it's through these events that it is defining its identity. So in a way, there's some crossover in that. And I'm moving on to a more global history, gender history, and global history. One of the projects I'm working on right now is global history through biography, or rather through historical memory, looking at a German Jewish communist woman named Olga Benario Prestes, who left Germany, went into exile in various locations, eventually in the USSR. Received military training, was assigned as the bodyguard of the Brazilian Communist Party, or the head of the Brazilian resistance, Luiz Carlos Prestes, went over to Brazil, supported the Brazilian communists in their revolt in 1935, was caught, deported back to Germany, and incarcerated pregnant. She gave birth in imprisonment, and eventually was murdered by the Nazis in an extermination camp. But I'm not really, as much as the story is about her, what I'm trying to look at is these global historical processes in the early to mid 20th century related to World War II, but also anti-fascism, and how important Latin America was in this global history, even though it's often sidelined through the life of Olga Benario Prestes. And also through her memory, she is widely remembered in Brazil, but often forgotten in West Germany, for example. And I think that forgetting is, the act of forgetting is very similar to looking at our emptiness, right? This is an act of forgetting. This is active forgetting. So while within East Germany, she was much more remembered. So that is what I'm turning to. I should also mention that Jennifer Keating, who was one of the co-editors on this volume and wrote a brilliant chapter within it, her book is also coming out next spring. It is On Arid Ground, Political Ecologies of Empire in Russian Central Asia. That's coming out with Oxford University Press. And my last thing I'd like to mention is Allegra Giovini. She's moving on to information sciences, and she very much loved your glossary of urban voice, and she wanted me to make sure to mention that to you. So
That's very, very nice. Thank you very much. When do you say that your book on Northeastern Brazil is coming up?
It's coming out in April next year. It's already available for pre-order.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Well, this was great talking to you and like breaking down a little bit more about the wonderful book that you edited with Allegra and Jennifer, Empty Spaces, Perspectives on Emptiness in Modern History. Thank you very much, Courtney, for your time.
Thank you, Sergio, for inviting me. I appreciate it.